We're going to start by looking at a character who's very overlooked in the Bible, overshadowed by his father and then by his sons. That's Isaac. So we're going to look at the one chapter in the Bible that's all about Isaac. Now, there's only one where he actually is the main character and not his children or his father. That's Genesis chapter 26. Genesis chapter 26. Now, this chapter comes in a bit of a strange place as it interrupts the story, which there's a lot more focus on, which is the story of Esau and Jacob fighting with each other. This chapter 26 interrupts that story. Right before it, Esau sells his birthright to Jacob. Right after it, Jacob steals the blessing from Esau. But in the middle, we get chapter 26. So this is just about Isaac. Though it starts out like this. There was a famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. Now, you'll see throughout this chapter, there's a lot of reference back to Abraham and comparisons with things that happened for Abraham. So there was a famine, and we're reminded of that first time when there was a famine when in the days of Abraham. Now, you remember what happened during that last famine. That's when Abraham decided to go down to Egypt, and he lies about his wife being his sister, and God has to protect him, and God does a better job of protecting him than Abraham did of protecting himself. So God protects Abraham, and God brings Abraham back to the land of Canaan. That was the last time. Now this time there's another famine, and so Isaac went down to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. So Isaac is also moving, and he's going down towards the south. He's going down in the direction of the land of Egypt, but in verse 2, the Lord appears to him. So verse 2 says, "The Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you.'" So if we didn't remember that context from earlier, we might wonder, why did God say, "Don't go down to Egypt"? Right? Why did he say that? It doesn't say that Isaac was about to go down to Egypt. But of course, we know that that's what his father did. So the Lord appears to him and warns him, "Don't go down to Egypt." And Isaac will be the only one out of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Isaac is the only one who always stays in the land of Canaan, right? Abraham lived in Haran, he lived in Canaan, and he lived in Egypt. Jacob is the same thing. Jacob lived in Haran, he lived in Canaan, and he lived in Egypt. But Isaac stays in the land of promise. So that's what the Lord tells him to do. "Stay in the land of which I shall tell you." That's the same words that the Lord used for Abraham. "I want you to be in the place that I will tell you about." Actually, the first time God speaks to Abraham, he says, "Go to the land I will show you." And the second time, God says, "Go to the land of which I will tell you." That's the time when he told Abraham to go to the land of Moriah. So Isaac was a part of that earlier story. And so now God uses those same words, "Live in the land of which I shall tell you." So Isaac has to live by faith in what God tells him. So verse 3, "Dwell in the land, and I will be with you." We talked a lot about that phrase the last time I spoke here, more than a year ago. That was the thing that Jacob had a really hard time understanding, that God was with him. But we see it here, this promise, "I will be with you and bless you. And for you and your descendants, I give for to you and your descendants, I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham, your father. I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So Isaac gets the promise of Abraham passed down on to him. And then this next verse is very interesting. It says, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Now, that's an interesting statement to make. Did Abraham always obey God's voice, always keep his laws? No. In fact, we're about to be reminded of that, right? Because one of the things that we saw Abraham do is he lied about his wife. And now Isaac is going to do the exact same thing. So whoever the Holy Spirit in giving us this text, we're very aware that Abraham was not a perfect person. And yet, he's described here by God as someone who obeyed my voice, kept my charge. How is that possible? Oh, we saw the verse earlier that Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So somehow, and maybe Isaac didn't understand all of this, but somehow God is able to overlook all of Abraham's sin and just say, this is a man who obeyed my voice. So, verse 6, Isaac dwelt in Gerar. And the men of the place asked about his wife. And he said, she is my sister. For he was afraid to say, she is my wife, because he thought, lest the men of the place kill me for Rebekah, because she is beautiful to behold. So he follows in his father's footsteps, and you can see the legacy of sin passed down. This is a big theme in Genesis. Children continue in their parents' legacy for good and also for bad. So in this case, we see the legacy of sin being passed down, the legacy of lying. So it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw, and there was Isaac showing endearment to Rebekah, his wife. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, quite obviously she is your wife, so how could you say she is my sister? Isaac said to him, because I said, lest I die on account of her. And Abimelech said, what is this you have done to us? One of the people might soon have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt on us. And you can see how afraid Abimelech is of this. Maybe he remembers what happened the last time with Abraham. So he tells Isaac, what is this you have done? Repeats that phrase. That's the same phrase that was used repeatedly to Abraham. What is this you've done to us? And we see that Isaac has made a mistake. So Abimelech charged all his people, this is verse 11, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. So once again, Isaac is safe, even though he, like, as far as he's concerned, he doesn't have any ability to protect himself, but God is protecting him. So verse 12, Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. So things seem to be going really well for him. We were off to a bad start with that lying, but the Lord is blessing him, and he's beginning to prosper. So verse 16, the man began to prosper and continued prospering until he had become very prosperous. That was in case you didn't get the point. It repeated it three times. He is prospering, and he prospered until he became prosperous. Right? Very, very repetitious here. For he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds. Again, in case you didn't get the point, a great number of servants. So the Philistines envied him. So right up until that point, this seemed really nice, didn't it? All right, everything is going really well. He's prospering. And then we just had to spoil it by getting to the end and seeing the Philistines envied him. Now, we read that God is with Isaac. And so it makes sense that he's prospering. That's something that we would expect. God is with you, you do well. But this next part, the Philistines envied him, that seems a lot more strange. We'll see that Isaac is going to suffer at the hands of the Philistines. And why is he suffering? What's the problem? Well, the problem is the same problem that his father faced. He is a stranger in a land that's not his own, right? So he is just a guest here. He doesn't have any power or ability to defend himself. But this is where God told him to be. So why has God brought him to this place where he is going to suffer persecution? So the Philistines envied him. Verse 15 says, the Philistines had stopped up all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, and they had filled them with earth. So here, for the first time, I guess it's not for the first time, but here we see one of the problems that Abraham had to deal with, and we're going to learn a little bit more about this. Abraham dug a bunch of wells, and there were water disputes. Now, there's only one mention where people fought over water during Abraham's lifetime. That's when he, I believe, he rebukes Abimelech after they make their covenant because some of his servants had seized one well that belonged to Abraham. They had stolen it. But we really didn't see a lot of this conflict in the days of Abraham. But now we're going to see that there actually was a significant fight that Abraham had to go through. So you start to see that now. The Philistines clearly had a problem with Abraham. They filled up all the wells that he had used. In verse 16, it gets worse. Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are mightier, much mightier than we." So he's getting kicked out, deported, sent away from Abimelech. So, verse 17, Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham, his father. So notice, this is very explicit, saying that Isaac is doing the same thing that his father Abraham had done. So he dug again the same wells which they had dug in the days of Abraham, his father. He needed to dig them again because they'd been filled up by the Philistines, right? So now he has to go through this work again. For the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names which his father had called them. Now that's going to be an important phrase. He called them the same names which his father had called them. So we'll see some of the names that Abraham had given to these wells. And those names will tell a story for us of Abraham's struggle and also of Isaac's struggle. So, verse 19. Also, Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well of running water there. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, which means quarrel, because they had quarreled with him. Now remember, this is the same name Abraham had given this well. So Abraham had named one of his wells Quarrel. All right, so that tells you a story already, that Abraham had been having a difficult time. And now you think maybe Abraham had solved all these problems, but now here is Isaac, and he's facing all the same problems his father had faced. So, verse 21, they dug another well, and they quarreled over that one also. So he called its name Sitna, which means enmity. Again, not a great name for a well. Verse 22, he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he called its name Rehoboth, because he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." So it's been a difficult journey, but after much struggle, Isaac has found a place where he can actually drink some water in peace. So then verse 23, he went up from there to Beersheba. Now, Beersheba is the place where Abraham had made a covenant with Abimelech. And in that story earlier, Abraham names the well Beersheba, which means well of the covenant, because of the covenant that he had made with Abraham. So now Isaac goes to that same place, and before we get the story of the covenant, the Lord appears to Isaac once again in verse 24. The Lord appeared to him the same night, that's the same night he came to Beersheba, and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake." Now, why would Isaac be afraid? Obviously, he's been through a lot. He was afraid earlier that people would kill him for his wife. Now he's been fighting over water rights. There's a lot of reasons for Isaac to be afraid, but the Lord tells him that he doesn't need to be afraid because God is with him. So, but it doesn't seem like God is with him, right? It says, from a certain perspective, from a worldly perspective, it seems like things are sometimes good for Isaac, sometimes bad. It doesn't really look that great all of the time. But he's come to this well of Beersheba. Verse 25, he built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. Now, Abraham had already dug a well in this place, but we read earlier that the Philistines had filled up that well, so he needs to dig it again. So they dug a well there. Then verse 26, Abimelech came to him from Gerar with Ahuzath and one of his friends, and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me, since you hate me and have sent me away from you?" And so you can see some bitterness here from Isaac. Why did you even bother coming here since you hate me so much? But they said, "We have certainly seen that the Lord is with you." So even people from the outside, and you would think that, you know, maybe they would look at all the difficulties that Isaac has been having and say, "Oh, the Lord isn't with him." But somehow they see the Lord actually is with him. So he said, this is verse 28, "Let there now be an oath between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, since we have not touched you, and since we have done nothing to you but good, and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." So they're the ones who are afraid now. They're afraid of Isaac, and they're engaging in some revisionist history. We've done nothing but good to you. We sent you off with a nice in peace. So verse 30, he made a feast, and they ate and drank. This is Isaac, who is not significant from the world's perspective. He is the one who is now hosting this king and his great officials. Then verse 31, they arose early in the morning and swore an oath with one another, and Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Now Isaac is the one sending them away in peace, right? And we see the reality, God's reality, that Isaac is the one who is blessed. He is the one who is significant. So the kings have come to him. It came to pass, verse 32, in the same day that Isaac's servants came and told him about the well which they had dug, and said to him, "We have found water." So he called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. So he called it, again, the same name that his father had called it. This is continuing that story. Isaac is following in the steps of his father. He's going through some of the same struggles and the same victory. So Isaac is a man who kings came to, and they wanted to make covenants with him. And that's the end of this story about Isaac. So we don't hear much about him, but we hear that he is someone who is continuing in this legacy of his father. And of course, we're also continuing in that legacy, that walk of faith, right? So we go through our lives here in this world, and God is with us. And we also go through struggles, right? We have times in our life where maybe we would feel the need to name something enmity or quarrel or strife, right? We go through these difficult times, and God doesn't rescue us right away, but we have an end that's promised for us, that the Lord is with us and that he will work everything together for good. That's going to be an important theme moving forward. Now, we can go into the next story, the story of Jacob, and we already talked a lot about that, so we're going to skip around in this a little bit, but I want to contrast some of the things in Jacob's life with some of the things that we've just saw in Isaac's life. So Isaac was told that the Lord was with him, and that was a repeated theme in that chapter. We don't read so much about God saying to Abraham that I am with you, but that phrase starts to be very important now in the story of Genesis. Of course, the Lord was with Abraham. But then we get to Jacob, and the story of Jacob starts out with a deception. He first makes a deal with his brother to kind of to take his birthright. That's not a deception, but it's certainly maybe not such a great move on Jacob's part. He gets his brother Esau to give up his birthright. And the reason that Esau is willing to do that is because he wants some food. Now, like father, like son, we read that Isaac loves Esau because he ate of his food. So just like Esau is motivated by food, we see his father Isaac seems to have a thing for food as well. And right, that he bases his love for his sons, at least partially, off of the food that they provide for him, right? So again, legacy of sin, there's a flaw in Isaac, and there's a flaw in his son Esau. And it's going to get worse, right? All of these flaws in Isaac, they get worse in the next generation. So in chapter 27, Isaac wants to bless his son Esau. And you, again, get insight into the way Isaac thinks, because his idea is verse 4 of chapter 27. His idea is, make me savory food such as I love and bring it to me that I may eat, and that my soul may bless you before I die. So Isaac ties his blessing to this food. He wants the food, and that is how he's going to be able to bless his son. Now, that's a flaw in Isaac that gets repeated in Esau. But Rebekah, she loves Jacob, and we'll see some of Rebekah's flaws get passed on to Jacob. So verse 5, Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son, and Esau went to the field to hunt game and to bring it. So Rebekah spoke to Jacob, her son, saying, indeed, I heard your father speak to Esau, your brother, and she tells him what had happened. Verse 8, now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to what I command you. And we talked about that last time. She's telling him to obey, but she's going to give him some wrong advice. And she says, go to the flock and bring me from there two choice kids of the goats, and I will make savory food from them for your father, such as he loves, and you shall take it to your father that he may eat it and that he may bless you before his death. So Rebekah has come up with this plan here, and she is really a woman of action. We saw that in a positive light earlier when we talked about the story of Abraham's servant. So earlier, Rebekah was a woman of action, and she channeled that into doing something good. She served this stranger who had come and watered all of his camels for him, and she's running back and forth between the well and the watering trough, filling it up for the 10 camels that had come down. Now, though, she uses this characteristic in a bad way. So she tries to take things into her own hands. She knows the promise of God that the older will serve the younger. And now she tries to make it happen using her own strength, right? We've seen this before in Abraham, in Sarah, in Isaac, now in Rebecca as well. They try to do things their own way. And Jacob is very much like that. He's a very active man, but he tries to do things his own way instead of listening to the Lord. So, and he goes and lies to his father. And again, we've seen lies before in this family. We saw Abraham and Isaac engaging in lies. Now, in the next generation, the problem has gotten even worse. Now there's even more lying, and now it's within the family, so Jacob is going to lie to his father. And so you can see things are really spiraling out of control in this family. We want to be following in the legacy of Abraham, who walked by faith and overcame struggles and was blessed by the Lord, and yet things really seem to be going out of control. And we talked a lot about last time about all of the struggles that Jacob went through and how he finally turns to the Lord and asked the Lord for his help and recognized, I don't have anything to offer you. I'm not worthy of any of the blessings you've given me. And he throws himself on God's promises and God comes through for him. But his story is really characterized by a lot of these sins. Then I'm going to skip ahead all the way to the story of Joseph. So I won't talk a lot about Joseph, but we'll finish off here talking about Joseph and how he connects to all of these earlier stories. So if we start the story of Joseph in Genesis chapter 37, this chapter starts off with a very interesting phrase. It says, Genesis 37, verse 1, Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. So that's good. And why is it a good thing? Well, it's connecting us back finally to that legacy of Abraham and of Isaac living in the land as strangers, they not having a permanent home. And now Jacob is doing the same thing. And this is especially important if you remember some of the things that Jacob tried to do earlier. Jacob tried to buy land. Jacob tried to settle down in Shechem and make himself a permanent part of the land of Canaan by joining, potentially joining with the people of Shechem. You remember that was a deal that was almost made. Why don't we join together and you give us your daughters, we'll give you our daughters, we'll intermarry, and we'll be one group. Of course, that plan was disrupted, and that's a good thing because God had not called Jacob to live like that in the land. He was supposed to live there as a stranger and not mix with the peoples there. Now, if you read chapter 36, which I'm not going to do, but if you read it, that's the story of Esau, who gets called Edom. And you see what Esau does is he settles down. He finds his home on Mount Seir. He intermarries with the people there, with Seir. And his children and descendants are powerful kings and rulers, and they have what seems like a nice, permanent, steady home. So Esau really looks like, compared to Jacob, Esau looks like the one who has come out on top because he has this home, he has this legacy of power, and he is settled. On the other hand, Jacob is here, and he is not settled down. So he seems like he's the one who has really gotten the short end of the stick, and it's certainly not obvious that the Lord's promise has come true, that the older will serve the younger. Esau seems a lot more powerful than Jacob. I think we could say that for sure. Not only are there these struggles with living as a stranger, so not only is that a difficulty that Jacob has to face, but he also has to face the continued legacy of sin in his own family. So just like Abraham and Isaac would lie, and just like Jacob ended up lying to his father, his children are going to end up lying to him. Just like there was favoritism that Isaac and Rebekah showed their children, Jacob is going to show favoritism to his children. And things are going to be taken to a whole new level. Just like there was sibling rivalry between Jacob and Esau, there's going to be sibling rivalry between Jacob's children. And it's getting worse, right? It's not getting better. It's getting worse. It seems like a very hopeless situation. We see, actually, this theme in several of the stories that are leading up to this point. There's, I don't know if I've mentioned this before. There's Isaac gets deceived by a goat. Jacob puts the goat skins on his hands. He goes up to Isaac. Isaac feels the goat skins. He's deceived. Then later on, Jacob gets deceived in return by Laban. Laban gets deceived by his daughter, Rachel, as they're coming back out. So once again, father and the parents and the children are deceiving each other. So that was the father and the daughter. Then Jacob gets deceived by his children, and once again they use a goat. They dip Joseph's coat in the blood, and they bring it to Jacob and say, "Do you recognize this?" And of course, you can't help but think about the way that Jacob had deceived his father, making him think that he recognized his son Esau when it was really Jacob. And then finally, Judah also gets deceived by his daughter-in-law. And again, there's a goat involved in that story. So this is across like four generations of people deceiving their parents and then being deceived by their children. So things are spiraling out of control. Jacob seems like the promise has not been fulfilled. And it's not obvious how God will solve this situation, how he's going to bring deliverance. That'll be the topic of a future message. All right, let's close in prayer. Lord, thank you for the stories in your word. And we know that we're hopeless without you, but you've given us hope through your son who you gave us to save us and to rescue us. So thank you for him. Thank you that through everything that we go through in this life, through ups and downs, you are with us and you protect us, and you promise that all things work together for good to those who love you, even those things that don't seem good at the time. So I thank you for that. Please help us to grow in our trust in you, to rely on you, and to understand that you are with us. In Jesus' name, amen.